I want to start off by, of course, thanking SEJ for making this possible, and also thanking our four panelists, all of whom are extraordinarily busy, for taking the time to come here, with, of course, a special thank you to Chairman Richard Pombo. A lot of people kept questioning me over the course of this conference whether he was going to show up, and you know, obviously inviting the House Resources Committee Chairman is a bit of a risk, but I knew that I had two critical allies in this, which is Brian Kennedy, his press secretary, who's wonderfully accessible and has been a huge help to me in my reporting, and also, most importantly, Mrs. Pombo, Annette, who I know that when she okayed the trip, he was going to come, and that was all that mattered. So I'd like to thank them for coming as well. So what we're going to just do is I'm going to introduce each of the panelists and let them speak for a few minutes, and then really we're going to open it up for questions. When we came up with doing this, what we decided is you know, we came up with the idea of what's in a name. I think both reporters and politicians know how important language is when you're talking about the environment. And this was conveyed to me extremely clearly last year when I was writing about the Bush administration's Clear Skies proposal. And the national editor of the Washington Post came over to me and he said, I just have one problem with your story, which is really not what you want to hear when you're on deadline. And I said, what is it, Mike? What's going on? And he goes, well, you know, you're using this language. You're talking about, you're using the administration's language, clear skies. And is that in some ways, are we promoting the administration by using their terminology? To which I said, you know, I don't remember people fetching over No Child Left Behind. I don't feel like that came up in our office when that happened. But, you know, obviously the environment is a politically charged issue, and we went over it and basically actually developed a policy where we would really talk about his air pollution plan and his efforts to curb different emissions. And we would talk about clear skies, but we would make clear when we used that language that this was the title that the administration had adopted. And I think that, you know, that is something that reporters have to keep in mind. And it is really interesting what you call any of your legislative initiatives can have a huge impact on how the public perceives them. And obviously, we're watchdogs, and we also do this when we're, of course, talking about environmental groups and their agenda. So we're going to start out with Chairman Pombo, as I mentioned before, who's serving in his seventh term in the House of Representatives, coming from Tracy, California. And he got the good news on his 41st birthday that he would be the youngest ever chairman in the House in its history and remains the youngest chairman. Which he has done since 2003, and, you know, again, made time to come here, coming fresh off a legislative victory, which obviously is huge, which many of you are familiar with. He has just gotten the House to approve by a margin of 229 to 193 in a bipartisan vote, with 36 Democrats voting for it, and on the other hand, 34 Republicans who voted against it, approving what is the largest overhaul of the Endangered Species Act in the 30-odd years of the law, and obviously he'll share those talks on that. I mean, he has worked on everything having to do with marine mammals to ANWR and energy issues as part of his chairmanship, and we're going to start with Richard Pombo, so if you want to start.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate being invited to come down. And I'm not going to speak for a long time and bore you with all that. But I think when you talk about the importance of language, the importance of the way that we talk about the environment, that's something that I think we've learned over the years, in the years that I've been in the House. And I think you've seen it in all aspects of legislation. You know, you talk about No Child Left Behind and the language that was used in that, or clear skies, or anything else. That has become the way that members of Congress try to influence the way you write about a story. Because if we call it clear skies, you at least have to refer to it and at some point by that name. And you can, you know, immediately peel off and start calling it something else in the story, but at some point you at least have to use that name. And I think one of the examples of that was the campaign finance reform. They called it the bipartisan campaign finance reform bill that moved through the House. And at the time that bill was introduced, they had one Republican on it. But it was the bipartisan campaign finance reform. When when you talked about the Endangered Species Act bill that, that just passed the House, immediately those that were supporting the substitute that we voted on began to call it the bipartisan substitute. And they had a name for it, but the first part of it was the bipartisan substitute. I had more Democrats that voted for my bill in committee than they had on the bipartisan substitute. But they put it out there as the bipartisan substitute, and that's the way a lot of people reported it, as the bipartisan substitute. And it was a part of the language, the way that they used the language. But I think it goes a lot deeper than that. And if you, when you talk about the environment, you can't get legislation passed with a catchy name. And it goes a lot deeper than that. And if you look at some of the things that we've done in the past couple of years, a lot of it's been actually working with people and trying to come up with something that you could at least get the majority of people to support. And we've been battling these issues for so many years, and you know, the polar opposites have been throwing rocks at each other across the House floor for so long. You know, that may be good for your base, that may be good for fundraising, but it doesn't get anything done. And one of the things that I brought to being the chairmanship was I told my colleagues is that I would take these issues off the table, that I would work to find a way to solve all these different issues that we've been fighting about for so long. And with what we were able to do this past week and on the floor, but over the last several months on endangered species, was come up with some new ideas and some new concepts that gained general consensus in the House. And I think more than anything else, I was proud that we were able to do that on an issue that we have been arguing about for so long. So I look forward to getting to your questions and being able to deal with some of the issues you guys care about.
Great. So now we have Carl Pope, who's executive director of the Sierra Club. He's been with the club for nearly 30 years. And since taking the top spot in 1992, the Sierra Club has added 150,000 new members. It now numbers roughly 700,000. The Aspen Institute, after surveying every member of Congress and key federal officials, named the Sierra Club as the most important environmental organization in Washington. And I think anyone who covers national politics knows what a role Carl has played, both in elections in terms of campaigns and also in the day-to-day work on everything from, you know, again, pending legislation to things like pushing to protect millions of acres of wilderness, particularly under the Clinton administration when they got some successes there. So, Carl, if you'll
please. Thanks, Julie. Well, it's wonderful to be here, and I'm going to begin by agreeing with the chairman. I, too, do not believe that you can get legislation passed in the House just with a catchy name. The function of this Orwellian language is not to gain votes on the House floor. Votes on the House floor gain in the way they've always been gained. Sometimes it's pretty and sometimes it's not so pretty. That's not new. But the purpose of Orwellian language, and, you know, lots of people have used Orwellian language. This did not start in 2001, is to muddy the public dialogue. It is not really even to fool people. It is to confuse people. I had a very interesting conversation with a distinguished member of the Society of American Environmental Journalists. I haven't seen him, so I don't think he's here today. We were talking about the Healthy Forest Bill. This particular journalist was convinced that the Healthy Forest Bill was a cover term for turning chainsaws loose in roadless areas. That was what he believed it was. And he said to me at one point, he said, well, Carl, how successful are you going to be at persuading the American people that this legislation is really all about logging and not about healthy forests? And I said, well, it would help a lot if you would stop referring to it in every paragraph as the Healthy Forests Initiative. And he said, well, you know the rules of the game, Carl. The President of the United States gets to name things. And I think I was actually very heartened by what the story you told, Juliet, because I think that it It is true in some sense, not just the president. Political leaders get to name things. Political leaders will use those names to frame and to tilt the playing field. And those of you who are journalists and who see your mission as being leveling the playing field need to be extremely thoughtful and conscious about how you react to that. And if you would actually raise the bar, which you collectively have the power to do, I suspect that both the chairman and I would rather actually fight it out about the things we disagree with and not try to muddy things up, but you actually leave us very little choice. We have to fight the name game because you actually don't do collectively a terribly good job of leveling the playing field around the name game. And it is indeed, while I would argue that some of the things we've seen from this administration have been quite extraordinary, it didn't begin with this administration. It goes all the way back at least to Henry Clay, who had the first political slogan that was like a new something, and it was the new nationalism. So this goes back to 1832 at least. But journalists have a lot to do with how important it becomes in our dialogue. The second thing I want to say is I think behind the name game, if you push and ask people, well, why do you call it Clear Skies? What is the defense? George Bush would be very upset with me. I hope you're more forgiving. It seems to me that the defense will be, look, we are trying to find a better way to do this stuff. And I think that is, as an opening comment, a fair comment. None of these bills were written by angels. They were all written by human beings. They're all administered by human beings. They're all profoundly flawed, like anything else human. So it shouldn't be beyond our capacity to find better ways of protecting species and giving landowners the right incentives and cleaning up the air and letting engineers who run power plants do the most efficient thing to clean up the air. All those things should indeed be achievable. But often, what is really being talked about is not using an alternate mechanism that will get us cleaner skies for a lower price, but an alternate mechanism that will get us dirtier skies for a lower price. And it seems to me that a signal failing of the journalism that I have seen is that you do not cut to that chase nearly high enough in the story. You go through the big debate about the mechanism, and you don't go and say, the bottom line is this proposal will achieve less, even though it's supposed to be more efficient, than the existing scheme which is being criticized for its efficiency. Well, if the new way of doing things, the more collaborative way, is more efficient, if it's better, it should be able to get more protection, not less. And when you see something that is offered as a more efficient way of getting the job done, and it is held to a lower final performance standard, you ought to raise a big red flag for your readers.
There you go. And as you can see, we're going to have a balanced panel where there'll be bashing of journalists as well as the administration. We're going to get more of that when we get to our final panelists. But now we're going to move on to someone who's going to be a little softer on us. Pat Parento is the professor of law and director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Clinic at Vermont Law School. He has operated on both sides of the fence, working at the National Wildlife Federation on their as vice president for conservation, serving as EPA's general counsel for New England under the Reagan administration, and then also environmental commissioner for Vermont, and finally as an industry lawyer working for Perkins Coie, the West Coast law firm, before, of course, taking refuge in the ivory tower where he resides now. He's written on the Bush administration's record, has done an analysis of how critical habitat works, and we'll talk now.
Thank you, Juliet. Well, first, I'd like to say that there are more people in this room today than were in all of the previous workshops that I've given over the last 6 years. So it's really nice to know that my reputation and fame has finally caught on. I really appreciate the recognition. Thank you. Thank you so much. The Reagan administration ushered in sort of the first significant broad-scale philosophical or ideological attack on federal regulation of the environment and federal protection, particularly governmental protection of the environment. You all recall the famous figures of that era, James Gaius Watt and Ann Burford Gorsuch, and you all recall that they're basically now footnotes to history. The big difference, and I unfortunately am a witness to this history, having been in this game, this business for over 30 years, and the big difference between what didn't happen in the Reagan administration and what has happened and is happening with Bush 2 administration is a fascinating topic that we don't really have time for. Part of it is because there is now a vertical integration of power in Washington, D.C., between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Part of it is because the issues have become totally incomprehensible to the average person, and the environmental community is in large part bears a lot of responsibility for that, as has been pointed out by many others. But frankly, and I'm not going to be awfully harsh on you, but frankly, one big difference I have seen is the reaction and the coverage of the media to the issues of the day. In the era in which Watt and Gorsuch were attempting to deregulate the environment and devolve federal authority to the states, they failed largely because the media refused to allow the spin and the stories and the rhetoric and the language to get in the way of what was really going on. And the stories weren't one-day stories. They weren't, excuse the expression, he said, she said stories. They were coherent. They were consistent. They were relentless. And in the end, they convinced the Reagan administration to drop it. And I can remember vividly a meeting with Mike Deaver in the White House in which he said, you know, you can stop talking right now because this just isn't worth it for this administration. And that's what stopped it. Now I want to talk about the rhetoric and the reality, and I'm going to cite, just jotted down, 10 ways in which the Bush 2 administration is going about dismantling environmental law, which is my view of it, and privatizing public resources. And then I want to give a few examples of what I think are really missed opportunities for a conservative philosophy of government. And I want to start with this language issue by simply reminding everyone that all of this was written out in very clear text by Frank Lutz in 2001 in the famous memo on how to talk about the environment. And it was a memo for the Bush White House, and it was a memo for the Republican leadership in Congress. And you can look at that memo from 2001, and you can look at the language of today and the debate, and you can see word for word how Luntz coached the current leadership in the Washington, D.C., in terms of how to talk about the environment. So there's the blueprint. If you're looking for the playbook or the blueprint, there it is. Now, the 10 quick ways in which this administration, under the radar, not in the traditional form of open democratic debate, transparent debate on the merits or demerits of environmental legislation, of which there are many, both merits and demerits, but rather how this administration goes about reforming, if you will, and dismantling, in my term, environmental law is very important. First, starve it. And Seth Bornstein and others have written very persuasively on how the administration defunds programs they don't like. He used Superfund as the primary example, hollowing out the program, crippling it, driving off the talented staff of the agency, leaving it with no money to clean up sites on the list, leaving it with no money to add sites, leaving it with no money to negotiate cleanups with private parties, a very effective job of absolutely demolishing a program for the cleanup of hazardous waste sites. Enforcement. We just came from a panel discussion. Enforcement numbers down across the board, any way you want to measure it, civil, criminal, judicial. Resources for enforcement down across the board. Enforcement staff reprogrammed into Homeland Security and in other ways. Issuance of guidance on what kinds of cases are suitable for enforcement referrals to the Department of Justice and what aren't. consent decrees, as Scott Streeter and others have written about, that go totally unenforced after having been entered into the courts. Failure to enforce the Endangered Species Act, which we just heard about in a panel. So the simplest way to gut an environmental law is not to go to Congress and repeal it, just don't enforce it. Third, rewrite the rules. The agencies have tremendous authority and discretion under all of these statutes. They're written very broadly. Our whole environmental program in this country rests on one word, discretion, and the exercise of discretion. And the assumption has always been that if Congress sets out broad goals and objectives and some standards to measure how we're supposed to move forward on these issues, the agencies would fill in the gaps, the agencies would issue detailed regulations, and those would become the blueprints for recovery and of water and air and habitat and all the rest. So rulemaking and rules is the Achilles heel of this entire system. New source review, we could go for hours on that topic, and I'm sure Bill will have some thoughts about that as well. But a rule that says that we're going to allow aging power plants, 50 of them, that are the largest emitters of carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, and mercury, that according to Apt Associates are killing 60,000 people a year, premature deaths from these power plant emissions, we're going to write rules that allow them to continue in operation by making changes to those plants up to 20% of the value of the plant, which in many cases works out to $100 million of improvements, and continue operating without controls on those emissions. That's the kind of rulemaking we're talking about. The roadless rule, almost 60 million acres, the last great places of the national forest system outside of the formally designated wilderness category, which is about 1% of the nation's lands. 60 million acres, high values for biodiversity, high values for watershed, high values for water quality, in a stroke of a pen, gone from this administration. National Forest Management Act rules that were written by the Reagan administration, that were written by scientists in a very carefully science-based process, gone. And I'll stop there. Guidance memos. One guidance memo under the Clean Water Act in the wake of a Supreme Court decision in Swank, 20% of the wetlands in the country gone from protection under the Clean Water Act. Sweetheart deals with industries, whether it's repealing critical habitat designations, whether it's settling takings claims that are bogus with irrigators taking federally subsidized water from federal reservoirs in California and then paying them when they have to be cut off because they're killing the Sacramento Run endangered salmon. Sweetheart deals, abuse of science. The Union of Concerned Scientists report laid that case out very clearly, cutting the public out of the process, categorical exclusions from NEPA, Forest Service appeals repealed, and I'll stop there and just mention a few of the things that the administration actually could have done that would have, yes, I can wrap up, that could have actually advanced some of these programs within their political philosophy. Subsidies. Whatever happened to the idea that we shouldn't be creating welfare giveaways for anyone, corporations included, the energy bill, the ag bill, the transportation bill, and now the Pelican bill in response to Katrina? Why not use public lands for critical habitat for endangered species instead of having private landowners bear that burden? Why not turn our publicly owned lands that belong to each and every one of us into a biological reserve for the United States? What's wrong with that? Why do we have to turn all those lands over to oil and gas and oil shale development and coal bed methane and so forth? Energy efficiency. We're at the lowest possible level of the fleet in our history. Why not get to 40%? Incentives. Mr. Pombo is absolutely right. We need more carrots and less sticks with the Endangered Species Act and others. But why not do it the right way, like the Farm Bill does it, with Swamp Buster and other programs? And I'll stop there.
Thanks. Okay, and now we come, last but not least, to Bill O'Keefe. Bill O'Keefe, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Marshall Institute, as well as President of Solutions Consulting. He served as Senior Vice President of Jelinek, Schwartz & Connelly, as well as Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the American Petroleum Institute, as well as Chief Administration Officer of the Center for Naval Analysis. And he's served on many boards, including Competitive Enterprise Institute, and is Chairman Emeritus of the Global Climate Change Coalition. All I'll say is when I need a smart conservative voice on climate change, I call Bill O'Keefe. You can call him, too, not on the days that I'm on deadline. But with that said, we'll let him talk.
Well, you should tell him to be careful what they call me.
Right. Careful what you call me.
I'm not going to beat up on journalists, and there isn't enough time to respond to the characterization of good versus evil, although I do think that makes a point that public policy and a lot of what you do is driven by images. And I think we've just seen an example of that. This is not new. One of my favorite books was written by Daniel Boorstin, the late historian who was the librarian of the Library of Congress, and if you haven't read it, it's worth reading. It's called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America, and it talks about the growing gap between what an informed citizen needs to know and can know, which is being filled with deceptive illusions. And those replace facts, and reality and facts get judged against image instead of the reverse. And the point, the case I'm going to make deals with the way the Bush climate policy has been characterized. When the president withdrew from the Kyoto process in 2001, and since then, he has been, they've been harshly criticized. He's been accused of turning his back on the most serious environmental problem in the history of mankind. The reality is that Al Gore went to Kyoto in 1997, engineered a treaty that he knew could not be ratified by the Senate. And the reason he knew that was in July of 97, the Senate voted unanimously to oppose any treaty that would inflict economic harm on the United States and exempt developing countries. The following year, President Clinton signed the treaty but said he would not submit it to the Senate until there was meaningful developing country participation. But developing countries were exempt, so they weren't going to participate, and they had no incentives to. What President Bush did was simply acknowledge reality, and it only proves the truth like no good deed goes unpunished. The Bush program set a standard for reducing carbon intensity. We can debate whether it was challenging enough or not. It involved bilateral agreements, multilateral agreements such as the recent Six Nation Agreement, the Methane to Market Program, sector commitments from industry, and big increases in spending, which if you put all this together, and I've said this to people from the EU, it is more than any other country is doing. And the fact that most of the EU countries will fail to meet their commitments shows how flawed the Kyoto Protocol is. They can't meet the existing commitments, and the ones after that would be even more challenging. That was the model that was being developed. We can do better in making environmental progress, but we only are going to do better when we get policies that are consistent with objective realities and facts, when we recognize that we're not going to turn the CO2 clock backwards, because that would involve abandoning fossil fuels, and we're not going to do that. They're too abundant. They're going to be used by developing countries, and those are going to be the major source of emissions in the coming decades. Whatever the problem, the magnitude of the problem is with climate change caused by human activities, the solution is going to be technology. And if we focus on technology and what can be done with new energy systems and improving energy efficiency, and find a way to collaborate on that instead of the bombast and clashes go back and forth, we will make some genuine progress. We'll make more. We have to be flexible. The other thing that we have to recognize is we can't will a future, and we don't know what the future will be 100 years from now, and it is the height of conceit to think that we can. We can't plan our energy and climate future like we would plan a long vacation going around the world where there's little uncertainty and a lot of predictability. What we can do is adopt an approach which takes small steps based on knowledge, and we adjust as we get new knowledge. It's what I call the Lewis and Clark approach. It's how they explored the territory west of the Missouri.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks so much. Okay, so we're going to open it up to questions. So line up at the mics. We'd like, obviously, SCJ members and other journalists to ask questions. If we exhaust all of them, then we can get to the activists, but we'll be fine with the journalists, I would guess. And also, we'd like questions and not monologues. So with that caveat, and we are going to wrap up right at 12:30. We have people with flights to catch, as well as, obviously, Bill Moyer's keynote speech. So.
Yes, my name is Dick Russell. I'm an author and a freelance writer, long time on the environment. My question is for Representative Pombo, and I'm not going to ask you about the Endangered Species Act because it's basically a done deal in the House anyway, but the National Energy Supply Diversification and Disruption Prevention Act, I believe, is another bill that you have introduced very recently, and I think this is the one that calls for opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling and the entire outer continental shelf off of America's 26 coastal states to drilling, which has long been opposed in many of them. Among the myriad of provisions in the bill is one that allows oil and gas rigs, which currently have to be removed 1 year after production ends by federal law, to be converted into fish farms in the open ocean, and basically lets these companies, as I understand it, avoid the paying the costs of removing the rigs. The question, of course, is whether these rigs can withstand force 3 or greater storms, also whether these platforms actually would provide suitable fish habitat. And my question to you, Representative Pombo, is how would you respond to the accusation that you are capitalizing on the human tragedy in New Orleans and afterwards to advance your own political agenda?
All of the provisions that are in the new energy bill, or the bill that we're working on right now, are all provisions that, for the most part, they're all provisions that have passed the House probably 5 times in the past. Right after what happened with the hurricanes and the shutdown on a lot of our energy production in this country, a number of senators who had previously opposed those provisions came out and said, we need to adopt an energy bill that actually focuses on domestic production and diversification of where we get our energy from. My part of the energy bill only, for the most part, only deals with public lands, public access issues. A lot of the provisions that deal with refineries and those things go through the Energy and Commerce Committee and are not in my jurisdiction in the committee. Obviously, ANWR is in the bill. It's controversial. It's something that we fight about at least once a year. And it usually passes the House, and it usually doesn't make it through the Senate. And that's something I think we'll probably be arguing about for a while longer. The provisions dealing with OCS, what is actually in the bill, in my bill, that we put together, was an opt-out program. We had states like California and Florida that do not want offshore oil and gas production in their waters. We extended out their control, and I believe it's to 125 miles, and allowed those states to opt out of any oil and gas production within 125 miles of their shore. It does allow states that do want oil and gas production to have oil and gas production in their state waters and to receive part of the revenue, just as we do in states that have public lands within their borders. It's basically the same model that we follow on oil and gas production on BLM land. But that provision is in the bill. Whether or not that ultimately ends up being in any kind of an energy bill that moves through the House, I don't know. That is just basically a way to put ideas on the table and say, these are the kind of things, if you want to diversify oil and gas production and where our energy comes from, those are the things that we could look at within the jurisdiction of the Resources Committee. We also do things on renewables, on wind and solar production, on geothermal off of public lands, and that is included in the bill as well, as it was in the House bill, as it passed the House several times in the past.
And I know Bill, I think, wants to follow up and comment, and if obviously the other panelists want to comment on that.
If you look at the long-range projections of the Energy Information Administration going out to 2025, it shows that the U.S. is going to be using much more energy than we do today, and over 80% of that is going to come from fossil fuels, with over 60% coming from oil and gas. Those numbers may be a little high, maybe a little low, but predominantly our energy source is going to be fossil fuels. So we have a choice. We can import oil from places we don't like, or we can look for it here. We can try and find natural gas here, or we can build LNG terminals. But we can't grow an economy, ignore the reality of the role of fossil fuels, and then turn our back on our own ability to produce resources. The OCS is viewed by the Department of Interior as being a very rich resource base. A lot of it is natural gas. The last offshore production accident was in 1969, almost 40 years ago. And Alaska, ANWR, could produce maybe nothing. Until you drill, you don't know what's there. But the estimates are 1 million to 1 million, maybe 1.5 million barrels a day in a very small area. The issue is, do we want to do it ourselves where we have strong environmental standards and can impose tough standards on development, or do we want to continue to complain about having to import from unstable regions of the world?
I'd actually like to sharpen the question up for the congressman, and I'm curious. You may have answered this, and if so, I'm just not certain. Do you personally favor drilling for oil and gas off the Northern California coast, off Monterey, off San Francisco, off Marin? I understand what your bill does, and it leads it to the state, but do you personally advocate drilling in those areas?
No, and I never have, and I've always said that I believe that that should be a state decision, and I personally have never supported drilling off the coast of California.
So you would personally oppose it if it came up as a state decision and you were asked for your view, you would oppose it?
In California, I would.
Okay.
Okay, moving on. Ray, do you have a question?
Yeah, I know there's going to be a number of pointed questions for Representative Pombo, and I have a number I could ask myself, but I thought I would add a little variety before everyone piles on.
Have at it. I don't care.
I was I'm Ray Ring from High Country News. We profiled you a little while ago, and you refused to participate in the story, so we did a 6,000-word profile without a quote from you. So I don't know that I need to ask you anything right now. I was struck by something Carl said about how everything that humans do is profoundly flawed. And, of course, I know that's true, reflecting on myself and my life and work. But it also fits into this romantic view that environmentalists tend to have of nature. Nature is somehow better. And I wonder if you would be willing to extend your observation to other species. Are elk and grizzly bears, or especially skunks and catfish and Canadian thistle and dandelions, profoundly flawed as well?
Well, some mountain lions are better at catching elk than others, and the ones that aren't very good at it have a hard time. So lots of other species are, in that sense, flawed. But I think your question opens the door to make a comment about what is different about human beings. We are, as far as we know, the only species which has moral choice. And all of the great religious traditions have concurred on this point. That's what makes us different. We choose. We don't have to stick with business as usual. And we are also the only species we know of that has achieved a level of impact on the biosphere where all other species, if they worry about us. That also makes us unique. So our flaws have consequences, which the fact that the skunk in my neighborhood may not really know how to appeal to the lady skunk in my neighborhood, That's bad for his genes, but not bad for his species. Our flaws could be bad for the whole biosphere.
Great. I'm Christy George from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Bill O'Keefe, you mentioned something I've heard many times before, which is that there's essentially always a technological fix for whatever ails the planet. And I'm curious about technological fixes for some of the really big things that we write about these days, like loss of topsoil, deforestation, depletion of, you know, permanent depletion of resources, and global warming. I mean, do we see technological fixes on the horizon?
Well, on global warming, I don't know of an alternative but to new technologies, because energy fuels economic growth. And as efficient as we may become, we're not going to reach a point where we can support a growing population with zero energy use. I mean, we can get more efficient, but we're going to use energy. And until we can find a replacement, a commercially viable, cost-effective replacement for fossil fuels, we're going to use that. There was an article in Science in 2002 that said if we exploited all the known technologies now, we couldn't stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations. We needed a whole new suite. We have progressed, and we have we're healthier. We live longer lives. We have better lives because of taking knowledge we acquire and converting it into things that add to our standard of living. So I'm very optimistic about our capacity to develop technologies to solve problems. I think we need to look at problems that are very serious, like in the third world, where we know how to solve a lot of those, and begin focusing on that and do less worrying about a potential problem a century from now. The data that I've seen shows that our environment has been improving since the first Environmental Act in the early 1970s, independent of who controlled the Congress or the White House. And I don't want to take a lot of time explaining why I think that is happening, and it includes increasing forest land. So we know how to use resources and protect the soil and not deplete it, and I think we do better than most other countries. So I'm an optimist, and I think technology is a major solution, but it's the right policies also.
Can I try to maybe just get a word in?
I know I had a filibuster, but anyway.
That's
true. All right. So can I go or no?
Yeah, go.
All right. So Bill has properly pointed out that we need to have some humility in the face of uncertainty, particularly with regard, in his case, he would say, to climate models and projections of global warming and the consequences that flow therefrom. I would suggest that humility probably also belongs in the faith that we place in technology. And I would submit just a few quick examples. I have to say, in my 30 years in working in this, I can't think of anything we fixed. If you think about even New Bedford Harbor, which we worked on at EPA for 15 years, is never going to be fixed. It's always going to be contaminated. If you enlarge the scale and scope a little bit and you talk about stratospheric ozone depletion, something like 80 to 90% of the ozone depleters are out of production. Those emissions are not occurring as a result of the Montreal Protocol. And yet, as we all know, the hole in the ozone layer is getting larger, not smaller. And there is no prediction as to when, if ever, it will close. And when the ultraviolet radiation that's pouring onto the planet and is closely linked with the massive die-off of amphibians across the globe, regardless of other habitat stressors, will continue. When I think about the cap-and-trade program that everybody cites as the miracle wonder of the market, acid rain, I live in the area where the original research on acid rain was done on camel's hump. It's the same as it ever was, a famous musician once said. The same is true of the Adirondack Lakes. Talk to Tom Eisner at Cornell. There's no response. There's no measurable recovery. Part of that is because we didn't regulate NOx when we set the cap-and-trade program, but part of it was because the cap's wrong. And why would we think it was right? It was an arbitrary cap based on what people thought we could accomplish, not on what was needed. And you can go on and on. The fact of the matter is that we're not very good at fixing the things we do. I was very struck by the general who's now in charge of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. As the Congress was busy readying a fascinating giveaway package of money for the terribly battered and Gulf Coast, and they were all, of course, loading it up with new levies, weren't they, and higher levies and bigger levies and stronger levies. And the general said, time out. This is the general of the Corps of Engineers. We don't need levies. We need a national flood policy that makes sense. So the idea that we can fix things or that we can build things that correct our mistakes, I would say the utmost humility is due for that proposition.
Well, very quickly, we are going to need to use new technology in the 21st century if we're going to solve the problems. Bill's absolutely right about that. We have a lot of it already. We're not using it. We're not using it because we continue to subsidize things that make things worse. And the Congress is getting ready to subsidize things that make things worse even more so. And if we really want to proceed in an iterative, humble, learning way, we ought to stop paying ourselves not to learn. We ought to stop paying ourselves not to change. We ought to stop paying ourselves to make things worse, because we are, in fact, responsive to price.
Okay. Mark.
I'm Mark Schlesstein. I'm a reporter with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and my question has to do a little bit with levees and a little bit with coastal restoration. Pre-Katrina, there was going through Congress a coastal restoration bill for Louisiana that specifically required a lot of money be spent on science and that scientists be required to keep checking the program as it moved forward to make sure that it was working accurately. It also included a provision that required any other federal programs that are operating in the state to comply with the goals and the projects that were going on in the coastal restoration program so that there was no screw-ups that might happen in the future. And it also required and included cost-benefit analysis. Now we're post-Katrina, and there's huge quantities of money being thrown left and right, or at least proposed to be thrown left and right, at levees and at coastal restoration. And the question is for all of you, what provisions are or should be included in all of these bills to require similar sort of checks and balances be placed on the post-Katrina era of projects in South Louisiana?
I'll begin on that and say that when it comes to what happened in Louisiana and other parts of the country, I happen to agree with the general at Army Corps that it's not just about levees. It's we need a flood policy that actually makes sense. Some states have developed state laws about building in floodplains and the wisdom of doing that. I don't care how big or how strong or how tall all of your levees are. There ultimately will come a storm that will take them out. And that has to be taken into account when you have your local land use planning and where you're going to go and ultimately what you do. On some things, Carl's actually right. And when it comes to subsidizing stupid things, Congress needs to seriously look at that. And there are a lot of times when we subsidize stupid things because it's politically easy to do. And the alternative to that will take a lot of flack, and members of Congress will take a lot of flack over it. But at the same time, I will tell you that we have existing levee systems that do need to be fixed. And it's a combination of how do you have a flood policy that makes sense and continue to maintain our current levee system? It's a balance. It's a combination of things. And, you know, you will hear people say that we should just tear down our levees and let things go back to the way they were. I don't think that's really what they want to do, or if they were in Congress, they wouldn't propose doing it, because politically there is no way in the world that you would ever have that happen. We are not going to tear down the levees around New Orleans and just let it go. And it's not that politically will never happen. So it has to be a balance between some kind of a rational policy on coastal restoration, on letting wetlands do the jobs that they're supposed to do, and maintaining the levees that we have so that we can keep cities from flooding.
I think I agree with everything you said.
Well, we're going to stop right there.
I think, again, that you guys can help. There are, in fact, some fairly straightforward ways of looking at what's really happening. We ought to try to minimize risk in these situations. We can't eliminate risk. We ought to prevent problems first, which we often don't do. We ought to protect people second, and we ought to figure out how we're going to rescue them third. And we ought to let scientists do what they do well, which is second-guess each other. We ought to have a lot of open, robust science driving this process, not a lot of politics and pork. There is not a long tradition of doing this way. So this will be something new we will have to learn. And if the media will keep going back to the basics and saying, is this going to prevent problems? Is this going to protect people? We will probably get it more right. We probably won't get it entirely right. But this could be made unimaginably worse. If we get this one wrong, the Class 5 hurricane that will hit the South Louisiana coast could make Katrina look like a minor event. We cannot afford to get it wrong again, and we easily could.
Let's go on to Rocky.
I'm pleased to see the consensus forming between Carl and the chairman, and I'd like to follow up on that. Chairman Pombo talked earlier about Representative Simpson's White Clouds proposal. Carl, could you see yourself and the Sierra Club supporting that new approach to wilderness, to preserving wilderness in Idaho and other places?
Well, I don't want to sign off on a particular proposal because I'm actually not familiar with the details. But if the discussion that has been going on in Idaho, and I'm closer to what's been going on at the Owyhees, you know, and I think that there are tremendous opportunities to sit down and figure out ways in which we can make public lands work for multiple stakeholders, as long as we recognize that there are certain uses of public lands, or of any land, which are incompatible with other uses. You know, you can't mine in a wilderness area. You lose the wilderness values. That's a reality. You can't have a bombing range. The issue in the Owyhees originally was a bombing range. And we've built a tremendous public consensus in Idaho that that region has higher values for the ranchers, for the local people, for the tribes, for the environmentalists than as a bombing range. And that's an example of how I think these kinds of things can work. So I don't know the details of the White Clouds, but yes, I do believe that a lot of these conflicts are artificially, I mean, I had one very strange experience right after the Clinton administration came in. I was invited to a meeting where we were trying to write rules for making movies on public lands. This was important to the Clinton administration. They had a lot of money from Hollywood.
It was. But you got invited to more meetings there than I did.
That's right. I was there representative of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and some people from the motion picture industry and from the state of Utah and from the BLM. the end of 4 hours, the movie people said, look, we need certainty. We need rules we can follow. We didn't know where we can go, where we shouldn't even think about going. At the end of 4 hours, we appeared to have complete consensus among all parties. Then the guy from the VLM said, oh, wait a minute. We can't give up our discretion. That word Pat used. Mm-hmm. We have to have the discretion to be able to make up our own minds what's going to happen. We can't sign off on this because this would be too cut and dried, too clear, too black and white, too easy for other people to use, and we couldn't sign off on it. The rules were finally adopted, but it then took 9 months to basically roll the bureaucracy. So the bureaucracy can be a problem.
They are a problem. If I could add on to that, this is probably one of the great debates that we have not yet had in Congress. And that is when you talk about specific wilderness areas. And the only way that I believe you're ever going to reach consensus in Congress and therefore hopefully some consensus amongst the outside groups is coming up with a much bigger plan. Carl talks about one part of Idaho. You're talking about a different part of Idaho. I've got probably 4 or 5 different wilderness proposals for the state of Idaho in my committee right now. The only way you're going to do that is if you pull all of that together and say, these areas are going to be wilderness. They're going to be designated as wilderness. These other areas are going to be multiple use. These are the kind of things that can happen here. These are the kind of things that can happen over here. And put set guidelines down that BLM or Forest Service or somebody else can't write their own rules and regulations on. And it's going to have to be done in a way that groups can't sue on it. Timber companies can't come in and sue. Environmental groups can't come in and sue. This is a broad consensus. This is how we're going to do an Idaho Lands Act. Because otherwise, 20 years from now, whoever has my job will be here, and whoever has your jobs will be here, and you'll still be talking about a proposal to do a wilderness area in Idaho. And we'll still be debating on it. We'll still be throwing rocks at each other. The only way it's going to happen is if somebody's got the guts to stand up and say, this isn't working. We need a new way of managing our public lands than what we're doing right now.
I said, Bill, you wanted to follow up?
Yeah, the clashes that take place between the private sector and the environmental community make for good theater. They're grist for journalism and writing articles. But in reality, they're sands in the wheels of progress. And I can remember 40 years ago, President Kennedy went to American University and gave a speech on arms control and negotiating with the Russians. And the philosophy he espoused was focusing more on the things that united us as human beings and less on the things that divide us. And I think if we could reach a state where in dialogue between business groups and environmental groups or within the Congress, there was more attention to the things we can agree on and build on that, it would build trust and better progress.
Great. And can we go to David?
Yeah, David Helvard. I'm an author and have a question that I suspect Carl Pope and Representative Pombo might not agree on. It's a way that the government, along with Iraq and the Gulf disaster, could spend tens of billions of more dollars. My first book, The War Against the Greens, I updated it last year. It profiles the wise use in property rights movements. And one of the tenets of the property rights movements is that any environmental and or other regulation that reduces an individual or corporation's private property values, even partially, should be financially compensated for by the government. I'm wondering what your feelings on that are.
Yeah, I'll start. That your tenet of the property rights movement is inaccurate to begin with, but what I have advocated in the past was that under the Endangered Species Act, if someone's property was necessary for the recovery of a species, that you had a number of options that you could take into account in doing that.
if you can have a cooperative agreement, a conservation easement, a management agreement, a contract, a long-term management scheme with that property owner so the land was managed in a way that increased habitat, increased the value of that habitat, and hopefully attracted endangered species to that habitat. If the Secretary of Fish and Wildlife determined that there was no way that person could continue to use their property, and in that case, the federal government should buy that property from them and relieve them of that burden. I've heard people who have made a lot of arguments about, you know, pro and con on that, but the federal government has done that repeatedly through, you know, our highway plans, through expanding national parks on wildlife refuges. I had a brand new wildlife refuge created in my district that was 100% on private land, and they have steadily gone in and purchased private land in order to return that into becoming a wildlife refuge. Nobody screamed and hollered and said, you know, you're paying them to abide by the law, because the law that Congress passed said we want a wildlife refuge there. No one screamed and hollered and said, that's unfair to pay those property owners because you're taking away their land. Under the Endangered Species Act, for some reason, people want to say, well, if we tell a farmer he can't farm part of his land, or we tell him that he can't use part of his land, that we shouldn't have to pay him for it because all they're doing is abiding by the law. I look at that as being something very different than requiring somebody to abide by the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act. I think those are two very, very different issues. When it came to the Endangered Species Act, I felt that private property owners should be compensated for what they're losing.
Okay, well, let me try to... I think there's a distinction between what people own, what is it you own when you own a piece of property, and in the American system, you own the right to have exclusive occupancy. Somebody else can't come onto your land. And you, depending on the state, own the right to certain reasonable expectations for the use of the land. You don't own the right to do anything you want to with your land. When it comes to the question of land which produces public values, the public value might be watershed, it might be open space, it might be wildlife habitat. I think that there is no constitutional right to be compensated merely because a regulation is passed which requires you to continue to produce that stream of public goods. On the other hand, I think there's an irony here because in some of these dialogues about what we should do, those on the other side of the ideological aisle from the environmental movement say they want a lot more purchase of private land. Well, that translates into more public land. Then they turn around and say they want to sell off public land we already have. Or we shouldn't allow more purchases of public land. And I can't sometimes quite figure out whether folks on the other side are in favor of more public land as a way of producing these public goods and services, which I'm in favor of. I'm in favor of buying a lot more land for wildlife habitat. I'm in favor of buying a lot more easements for wildlife protection. I just don't think that you should take an entire statutory scheme and say anybody complying with this automatically gets access to those dollars, regardless of the facts and circumstances. On the other hand, I do want to say there's something else we do agree about. Mr. Pombo's bill, which I strongly opposed, included a provision which was a provision to survey the public lands for what new national wildlife refuges. We need to fill out the national wildlife refuge system. And I want to say that I strongly support that provision. In fact, I think we actually originally wrote it, which you probably weren't aware of.
Actually, I was.
You were. That's good. Well, that's good. And I hope.
And I accepted it anyway.
And you accepted it anyway. Well, that is generosity of spirit. And I think I do hope that if the Endangered Species Bill, which you've put through the House, does not pass the Senate, which is my hope and my expectation, that we will be able to revisit it and at least move some of the things on which we agree forward and not say, well, since we can't agree on everything, we can't agree on anything.
I'd like to really get in on this because this actually this is something I'm supposed to know something about, which is law. And the first comment is that not only does the group that or the community of interest that describes themselves as property rights oppose government regulation that affects the taking and want no further public lands, they also oppose conservation easements and tax credits for conservation easements. You should also know that as well. They are formally on record as urging Congress to repeal those tax credits for conservation easements. But to the specific question, and here I think Mr. Pombo, here's where I think you had a good idea that went wrong with the bill that just passed the House, and I do hope the Senate can correct it. There has never been in 33 years of the Endangered Species Act a single case of taking. That's remarkable. There have been many, many efforts, and I've been involved in some of those efforts. Many different theories that have been tried by the Pacific Legal Foundation and others, they've thought of everything, and nothing has worked. The only time anybody ever got a payment under the Endangered Species Act is when the Bush administration settled the Tulare Lake case when it was on appeal, and every water lawyer in the country said that there was no basis for the lower court's decision. That's the only time there had ever been a payment under the Endangered Species Act. So there's really no legal predicate whatsoever for payment of monies, public monies, taxpayers' monies, to landowners for the effects of critical habitat designations, jeopardy opinions, incidental take permits, anything that's ever happened under the Endangered Species Act. There's no legal predicate for that whatsoever. What there is a very strong public policy argument for is payments to landowners who do the right thing by way of habitat conservation. But the way to do that is through the recovery process, not through some cockamamie theory that landowners have a right to destroy habitat under the Constitution and be paid when the government says you can't. That's going nowhere. It's going nowhere legally, constitutionally, and I hope it isn't going anywhere politically. I know we're in a very strange period of time in this country, but I hope that there's some adults on duty in the Senate who can manage this debate and focus on the real question, which is, what is the correct public policy response when we want private landowners to do things that create social benefit? That's the question. The Farm Bill is the model. The Farm Bill is the model. In exchange for subsidies to grow crops, you don't destroy wetlands. In exchange for subsidies to grow crops, you don't crop on highly erodible soils. In exchange for pumping the Edwards Aquifer, you employ energy efficiency. You line your ditches. You use laser technologies if that's available for irrigation, and so on and so on and so on. You use the ability of the federal government and its fiscal and tax policies, not its regulatory policies, to achieve highly desirable social ends. If the bill that passed the House had done that, you would find very, very broad support throughout the land, including the conservation community.
Okay, and I think basically we're almost out of time. Do you have a super, super quick question?
No, actually, I've been asked to be the enforcer and say that with the 12:30 rule, there can be no more questions. And also,
excellent.
I'm sorry, I'm the bad guy. The other thing is to, as a public broadcaster, to make one quick pitch, which is that we are recording this session, as well as Bill Moyers and a few others. And if you're interested in copies, to talk to the SCJ office on Monday, and copies will be available.
Right, and so, can we just have a round of applause?
Before everybody runs out, I did want to have an opportunity to say what you just saw with my definition or my opinion on what my bill does and a contrasting opinion where journalists can really get themselves into trouble is they walk out of here and say, this is what the bill does based on what I said or based on what he just said. Actually, look at it. Look at it and see what's in there. That's what I challenge you to do. Actually, look at the bill because he's not right and I'm probably not right.
And it's not he said, he said. There is a bill.